Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Candelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. In the Podbooth studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, and we'll be speaking with Professor Michael Wesley, the Deputy Vice Chancellor at Melbourne University, about the growing security challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Professor Wesley is responsible for leading the university's international engagement and has published on Australian foreign policy and Asia's international relations. Experts in this field have been analysing threats in the region and examining China's more aggressive policies over almost a decade. Professor Michael Wesley, Australia's new Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has just held a one-on-one meeting with his Chinese counterpart in Singapore, officially ending a long diplomatic freeze between Canberra and Beijing. Do you think this augurs well for a resetting of this troubled relationship between the two countries?
Look, I think it's a good start. It suggests that we might be headed for a stabilisation of the relationship. I don't think we can expect a return to the days of closeness and warmth between Australia and China. There's simply too much water under the bridge now, and I think really the two countries' strategic perceptions have diverged markedly. I think what we can really hope for is the stabilisation around a pragmatic relationship between Australia and China, which will comprise of something like the following: Australia and China agree to disagree on a range of different issues, they realise that they will be in strategic competition in places like the South Pacific and Southeast Asia, but there is a recognition that there is deep and sustained economic complementarity between the two economies, that both countries probably need their trade relationship and to some extent their investment relationship in order to ensure their ongoing prosperity, but this will need to be buttressed with a very firm understanding that economic interdependence between the two countries is not weaponized in future. And I think Australia will require some pretty clear guarantees that that is the case if it is not to continue to try and diversify away from China, which I think Australia will do anyway.
You've told Sky News recently that China is ramping things up in the Pacific and that this is all part of China's strategy of pushing the United States and its allies out of their position in the Pacific as sole guarantor. What do you actually mean by that, and what does that mean for Australia?
Well, what I mean by it is that this has been a very long-term objective of China. That I think goes back until the late 1970s at least. And that is to change the situation in the Pacific, whereby since the end of the Second World War, the United States has been the sole and largely uncontested guarantor of regional security. China wants to replace the United States as the paramount power in the Pacific, which means getting rid of the United States, pushing it out in effect. So for some decades now, China has been looking to loosen everything on which the US presence in the Pacific is predicated, be it US alliances with countries like Australia and Japan, be it institutions in which the United States is a leading member in this part of the world, or areas such as the South Pacific where key US allies such as Australia, are seen as the metropolitan power, and the South Pacific is part of that. So I think China's strategic competition with Australia in the South Pacific is a subset, if you like, or a reverberation of China's larger strategic competition with the United States, and is is really designed to push the United States as far back in the Pacific as is possible.
Well, we saw only last week, recently, there was a pitch by the Chinese in the Pacific that appears at this initial phase to have been rejected. What does that say about where those Pacific nations are at, where Australia's at, and where China's at in the Indo-Pacific at the moment?
Well, I think first and foremost, it shows China is very inexperienced in working in the Pacific. It came in with a very big proposal, which it really dropped on Pacific leaders and asked them to sign up to it without having talks among themselves. The Pacific is a region that values Talanoa, as they call it, deep and extended discussion among members of a group or a family before any collective decision is made. There was simply no time for the leaders of the Pacific to do that. But we've seen China act hastily and impatiently in the Pacific before, particularly around issues of the recognition of Taiwan and the admission of China into consultation processes. So this is something that I think China tends to be prone to and will not make China a welcome interlocutor in parts of the Pacific. The other thing I would say is that the Pacific in general is very divided over China. And it's divided between countries and within countries. So between countries, we see a country like Palau or the Federated States of Micronesia, which is very sceptical of cozying up to China or developing closer links to China, whereas you have other countries such as Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, to an extent Fiji, to an extent Samoa, which are much more forward-leaning on developing close relations with China. You also have divisions within Pacific countries, and these are usually divisions that divide the populations of Pacific countries from their political elites. And I think you can see that most clearly in Solomon Islands, where you've got a government that is very pro-PRC and has recently signed a security agreement. But on the ground in Solomon Islands, there's a great deal of skepticism, worry, and I would even say antagonism. And then in the Solomon Islands, within its federation, we can see regional governments like that of Malaita province, which are very much at odds with the Sogabare national government's pro-China policy. So I think what we saw in Wang Yi's visit was really putting into stark relief a lot of the difficulties China will have in developing the sort of substantial presence in the Pacific that it really wants.
Michael, can I just shift our focus to the ASEAN region? Now, our Prime Minister, within the first fortnight of becoming Prime Minister, went to Indonesia with a small delegation, including our Chair, Professor Margaret Gardner, so clearly education was on the agenda. Do you think that we haven't paid enough attention, and I'm talking at the macro level, but also even just at the innovation level, research, education level, as governments and universities to that region, first question? And second question, what do you read into that meeting and the fact that he did actually want universities at that table?
So at the government level, Vicky, I think we have definitely been paying attention to Southeast Asia and putting resources into Southeast Asia. What I'm sceptical about is whether we've actually achieved any diplomatic or sufficient diplomatic payoff for all of our resources and all of our attention. We've been, if you look back at the past 5 years or so, we've held an Australia-ASEAN summit. We've concluded strategic partnerships with Vietnam, with Singapore, with ASEAN itself. We've been developing all of these proposals, and yet there seem to be mixed messages about what Australia wants in Southeast Asia. On the one hand, we claim to be a partner to Southeast Asia, On the other hand, I think that there is very mixed perceptions of what Australia is doing through the Quad relationship, for example, with the United States, Japan and India, through AUKUS with the United States and the UK. And while there are some in Southeast Asia that are supportive of these sorts of moves on Australia's behalf, there are others who say, well, do these moves reflect the fact that Australia has given up on its partnerships in Southeast Asia? So I think the collective outcome of all of that is a bit of confusion. People don't really know what Australia's overriding objectives and reasons for being in Southeast Asia are. And that would be the first thing I would urge the new government to clarify. In terms of universities, I think our kind of record on Southeast Asia has been somewhat patchy. I certainly think that we could be paying a lot more attention to Southeast Asia. If you take a long-run view, Australian universities have a very proud history in Southeast Asia of welcoming Colombo Plan students, welcoming Australia Awards students. I welcomed a group of about 160 Australia Awards students to the University of Melbourne this morning, and it's just fantastic to see them. But I think we could be doing a heck of a lot more. I think that education is the cheapest and most effective soft power a country like Australia can deploy. And I would urge both universities and governments to come together and to really ramp up the imagination about what we can do to extend Australia's world-class higher education to more people, more young people in Southeast Asia.
So given that very complex sort of picture you've painted with China, the Solomon Islands or the Pacific and ASEAN, as universities, I think we've got a role to play which is beyond just student recruitment. I mean, there's a lot more that we can and should be doing in terms of capability building and that soft diplomacy as you talk about. Is it possible to walk and chew gum? Is it possible for us to have strong relationships in the region whilst that complex picture you've just painted is actually swirling around us?
I'd go beyond saying it's possible and say it's imperative, Vicky. What we are seeing in both the Pacific and Southeast Asia is really a soft power competition. And so far, I think our soft power response to China's has been totally misplaced. My problem with the way in which we've responded to China's charm offensive in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific is to try and counter whatever it is that China does. So China announces an infrastructure fund, we announce an infrastructure fund. China announces programs around education and security building, we announce countering initiatives. I've long said that Australia in both Southeast Asia and the Pacific has enduring strengths that China will never be able to match. That is the length of our historical engagement in those societies, the very strong feelings of goodwill there are towards Australia in societies in the South Pacific and Southeast Asia, and our outsized advantage in being able to contribute to human well-being. So education, as I said before, health systems, all sorts of capacity building in areas that will make a big difference to people's lives, that's where we should be concentrating our efforts, not going head-to-head with the Chinese.
How do you think, a few weeks into the new government, how do you think they have performed in terms of the Indo-Pacific and the way in which they've dealt with some of these geopolitical issues?
Well, about 3 weeks in, it's hard to fault them, really. I mean, it's been a period of absolutely frenetic activity from the Prime Minister's dash to Tokyo to take part in the Quad summit. I think his visit to Indonesia was very well timed and very well conceived. Australian Prime Ministers have traditionally made their first overseas trip to Indonesia. It sends a very strong signal. Obviously, because of the timing of the Quad summit, he couldn't make that visit to Indonesia, but he certainly made a trip to Indonesia soon after. And I think the foreign minister's work in the Pacific has been absolutely pitch perfect. I think her messaging has been spot on, her willingness to listen and her willingness to be in the region, I think, has been absolutely well received. And I look forward to seeing much more of it. I think if the government continues along these lines, then we'll start to see some real diplomatic payoffs.
You and I have travelled together to the US pre-COVID, and that was at the time when the issue of foreign interference and foreign influence was at its height, and we had several meetings in the US with various agencies, et cetera, and they have had a very strong and very outspoken anti-China sentiment as opposed to our then government having an agnostic view, at least in terms of how they presented it. Do you think that foreign interference and foreign influence hasn't necessarily changed, but do you think we'll see a dial down in the rhetoric now with the new government, or do you think it's as sort of omnipresent as usual?
I guess I shouldn't reveal, Vicky, that when we're in Washington, you and I visited the International Spy Museum.
We did. Which is probably not something we want to, I should have worn the t-shirt today.
It was a very interesting visit. No, look, my sense is that the weaponization of national security for political purposes will not be a feature of the landscape as it was in the past government. I think that there was an extent to which the previous government used foreign interference and national security very much as a domestic political mechanism. I have the feeling that the new government won't be playing those games, even though it will probably be wary of being painted by the new opposition as being soft on foreign interference and soft on national security.
And that's the risk, so, right? That's the risk, isn't it? That they would
right.
be very alive and attuned to.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think the universities and the government have a common purpose here to come together, to leave no stone unturned, to show that the university sector is taking the risk of foreign interference very, very seriously, and it is working in partnership with the security agencies of government to make sure that we are as resilient as possible. So if I can give you an example, here at the University of Melbourne, we put in enormous resources to building our resilience against foreign interference. That's a sunk cost for us. We've already done it. We've done the work. We're not going to resile from that. I think we have become much more resilient to foreign interference. And I think without the combative atmosphere, I think, I'm hoping that we can look forward to a collaborative relationship with the government around building Australia's collective resilience to foreign interference in our knowledge sector.
Just to another issue, I was intrigued before when you were talking about there was this confusion within ASEAN nations about where Australia stands. What does that mean ultimately then for the student intake from this part of the world? And should we be taking more students from ASEAN nations as opposed to China?
Absolutely, we should be taking more students from ASEAN nations. I think that, as I said before, and as I firmly believe, Australia, as a country in Asia and the Pacific, does have an obligation as a wealthy, advanced country with a world-class higher education system. We have an obligation to meet the growing demand in Asia and the Pacific for quality higher education. And we also have an obligation to help our neighbours in those regions build their own quality higher education sectors as well. So to give you an example, the University of Melbourne has been working with several Indian universities to co-design world-class Bachelor of Science programs, which are then delivered by those Indian universities to provide young Indian people with a world-class science education for them to go on and help build their own countries and their own careers. So we should be looking to South Asia, to Southeast Asia, to the Pacific and beyond to increase the diversity and the richness of our international student cohorts, because it really does benefit Australia and its higher education sector to have more diversity among our student cohorts and among our staff cohorts as well.
You talked about this idea of soft diplomacy and the role that these students can play. How do these international students, particularly from GO8 universities, play a role in developing a more peaceful and harmonious Indo-Pacific region?
Well, I think simple understanding is the start of a lot of things. One of the things that does worry me is we're starting to see a fracturing of worlds, if you like. It's harder and harder for people in China, for example, to access global sources of information, to access Western sources of information. Similarly, we're finding it harder and harder in countries like Australia to access the sort of popular information that people in China are able to access. And what that leads to, I think, is a fracturing of understandings and disagreements about, you know, the same things that are happening in the world. So one of the things that international education provides is a perspective, a broader perspective on what's happening in the world. The more of our people we can send overseas to understand the way the people in other countries think, and the more people from other countries we can bring to Australia to understand broader global flows of information, so much the better. I think this is an investment in, as I said, soft power, but also an investment in global understanding that will pay off in spades, given the relatively small amounts of resources we have to put into it to really scale it up.
You've talked about the flow of information, and you've been a critic in the past of policy think tanks and news limited media to an extent. Given potentially the changed environment we're in, how do you think they will now be responding to this kind of shifting dynamic that we're seeing?
Look, it's hard to say. I guess one of the things that's been disappointing, particularly through the years of the pandemic, has been the level of kind of vitriolic and impassioned commentary about Australia's university sector and the really negative stereotypes that come out of some policy think tanks and some sections of the media. And really, for anyone who works in universities or the university sector, they really are cases that are built on really simplistic stereotypes, quite often imported straight from the United States and quite often completely at variance with what's actually happening in Australian universities. So one of the things I'm really hoping is that over time the sector can work with broader public interest organisations, be they think tanks, be they sections of the media, to really sort of enhance the flow of understanding and information. And I'm all for public discussion and debate over our higher education sector. I'm all for public discussion and debate over our research sector. These are public institutions and they deserve to be debated. But let's debate them from positions of knowledge, from informed positions rather than stereotypes. Mm. That's what I'm sort of hoping for in the future.
And that's what we're trying to do, I think, through these podcasts is sort of be able to direct that conversation in a better way than what we've had in the past. So we hope that we can achieve that, because I think that's really important.
Absolutely. Mm. Just finally, are you confident about where Australia is heading in the Indo-Pacific and China more generally? And what role do you see universities playing in future to improve that situation?
I wouldn't say I'm confident. I do worry about the complexity and the instability in Australia's region. I think that the rivalry between China and the United States is deepening and spreading to more and more sectors. I worry about the implications of the tech decoupling that's happening and what you might call the information decoupling that's happening, where you will see, I think, increasingly divergent views on what's going on in the region and who's in the right. I think Australia, in pure defence terms, is dangerously unprepared. I think we've had decades of bungling in terms of defence procurement. I think we've run down our foreign policy and diplomacy capabilities. We've run down our foreign aid capabilities. So I really do worry about the future that confronts Australia. But I do think that when Australia has confronted really difficult and really challenging times, we have pulled together and we have started to become very creative in what we've been able to achieve. And we've got a history of really significant foreign policy achievements to that end. So look, I'm hoping as an Australian foreign policy scholar at an Australian university that we will see a renewed period of collaboration between the Australian government, between its universities, between its think tanks, and we can all collaborate on putting Australia in a much firmer position and contributing to a much more stable region in future.
Professor Michael Wesley, thank you very much for your sobering thoughts and insights. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.